to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 864. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at the Reformed Forum office, our RFHQ, we affectionately call it. And it's a wonderful day. It's a good Thursday. And I have with me a friend, Dr. David Noe, who serves as pastor of Reformation Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. Has served the OPC in a variety of ways and ecclesiastical committees and other special projects. And for a long time, was on the faculty of Calvin University, even chairing the philosophy department and teaching in the departments of philosophy, classics, and history. And that's germane to our subject today. But before we get into that, welcome, David. It's great to have you. We're glad to have you back just on the heels of this Francophone symposium that we had.
Yes, thank you so much, Camden, for having me back. It's a delight to be with you.
Yes, we appreciate that. I usually get comments sometimes when I call in on Zoom to places. If I'm in this particular room, people will sometimes ask if my background is real. And I'll have to sometimes go and grab a book off the shelf and prove to them that it's real. So I need to ask for the people that are watching on video, they're going to want to know. Are the particular books in your background real?
The particular books are real, but the background is 100% phony. So,
but you,
this is someone else's photo. So
it's a beautiful photo. Yes, the books indeed are real. This is not AI generated.
No
graphic.
But they're definitely phony. So the photo was phony.
Well, it's still a grand picture, and we're going to be talking about lots of old books today. Speaking about antiquarian books and books of the Reformation, particularly as we discuss the Meter Center at Calvin University and Calvin Seminary. David's done quite a bit of work there and has taught courses and done other colloquia and various scholarly activities. We're going to speak about this because David's been doing some things most recently, having an event even last week in terms of our time that we're recording, which is very close to when this episode should be coming out. And we're looking forward to talking about that, but more in general, speaking about Latin studies, Latin scholarship, and the importance of studying things in original language and looking at the influence of the Reformation upon the Christian tradition more in general. There's an important and significant role of classical authors in Reformation thought, and we'd like to expose that more. And who could we have better than to do it? Dr. David Noe. So, David, what happened last
week? Is that a question? Because I can think of a few individuals who would do a better job
I appreciate that humility, but also you're a friend and a friend of the program, so we like having those close to us to do this as well. But I'll start with that question, though. Who are some of your colleagues and other well-respected people that are also working in this space as people might want to follow up?
Right. Well, you know, there's always a danger that if you mention some folks, you will leave out others who are equally or perhaps even more deserving. So I can only speak to what knowledge I have, which is obviously quite limited. Calvin talks in the Institutes about something he calls docta ignorantia, right? So ignorantia is ignorance, but a docta ignorantia is a learned ignorance, which is basically a Socratic idea along the lines of the really wise person knows just how foolish and ignorant they are. So I would say a large part of learning some discipline is learning the boundaries of one's knowledge, right? Beyond which lies a vast abyss of ignorance, right? And so other individuals, Dr. Kirk Summers, who is down at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, a fantastic scholar of Theodore Beza, and of many other authors. He's been a great inspiration to me and a model for me of doing this kind of work. Of course, Richard Muller here in Grand Rapids, not so much dealing with classical authors, although he's capable, very capable, but obviously indispensable for repositioning Calvin with respect to the Reformed Orthodox. My good friend Joseph Tipton, who is teaching down at the Geneva School in Orlando. And Joseph is starting to contribute a lot to some of these kinds of projects. He's working on the Rutherford project that Chad Van Dixhorn and I have been working on. Joseph's an absolutely fantastic Latinist. So everyone who does something that's technical and difficult, which is what I'm doing, needs to have a kind of a, you know, a group to consult when he gets stuck.
Yeah.
So the folks that I call upon are Joseph, Kirk Summers, and then my friend, Dr. Patrick Owens, who is in the Roman Confession, and is a fantastic Latinist, one of the best in the country. And so when I get stumped, which is not infrequently, these are the individuals I call upon. They're always very generous, you know, and they say, well, you probably would have figured it out in, you know, just a little more time. And what you really need is just another set of eyes. I don't know if that's always true. Sometimes I stare at something and I think about it and I can't find the solution.
Yeah.
But someone else, you know, by a kind of inspiration, figures it out instantly. I'm talking about, you know, some difficult passage of Latin that I just can't make sense of. So
that is wise. I very much appreciate that. I've been thinking about that more recently, and just in terms of just general habits and practices of scholars. And you need to have, I mean, to use a more colloquium or a more colloquial or contemporary term, you need to have a scene, you know, in the sense of just having people that you're interacting with regularly. I'm thinking even, I suppose, maybe 100 years ago in France, in Paris, with the Movable Feast and Hemingway and all the painters and writers and other people that were always interacting with one another and sharing ideas. But even within your discipline, if you're not regularly corresponding with people that are working in a similar space than you, you're really impoverished. And we're communal beings, but it's important because there's wisdom in many counselors in one regard, but also just being able to see things from a different perspective. And everyone brings something unique to the table, no matter who you are.
Right.
And having that variety, diversity, even of ways of approaching a question is so important. So we need to find ways to do this. Professional learning communities is one way that people do this, I guess, in the educational space. But I'm hoping that, I don't know, maybe Reform Forum or other organizations can help, or just individuals, we can help contribute to that, especially with the tech that we have these days. We can.
Yes.
It's mostly just a discipline of organizing and making time in your schedule to speak with others. But we need to be doing more of this stuff as pastors and as scholars.
Right. So here's a illustration of that, perhaps. You can tell me if it's apt to the point. And that is, Calvin was convinced that if only he could speak directly to Luther, that the two of them could sort out the proper understanding of the supper.
Mm.
Pardon?
I would say, I said totally that, you know, in my bright, my bright language, now certainly there might be some irreconcilable differences, but I absolutely resonate with the sentiment that speaking face to face and working through issues immediately like that can be so helpful to find out what the concerns are.
I'm not sure if that's true, honestly, because at the Colloquy of Marburg in 1529,
well, that's true.
Luther and Melanchthon, you know, versus Ecolampadius and Zwingli with Bucer in attendance, they spent several days and there was no rapprochement. But Calvin actually wrote a letter to Luther, a very good letter, calling him a father, you know, heaping on him lavish and, I believe, genuine praise. And he sent it to Melanchthon and he said, Melanchthon, please give this to, you know, Father Luther, because this, if he just reads this and takes seriously what I'm saying, all of our disputes will be settled.
Mm-hmm.
And Melanchthon did not give it to Luther. Wow. He never handed it to him, because I think Melanchthon was wiser than Calvin in this regard, knew Luther much better and realized, if Luther reads this, it's just going to set him off further.
Mm.
But I bring it up because I think, imagine if Calvin could have a Zoom call with Luther, right? You know, one a Frenchman, the other a German, separated by about 20 years in age, both speaking Latin. Could they have resolved it? I don't know.
It would have been certainly worthwhile at least having the conversation. But again, you're thinking Luther especially and others have a certain disposition where if we do have a more open, charitable, and honest, good faith conversation, I think that's good for scholars to interact with. But if there tends to be this undercurrent of competition or people trying to stake out a claim or a territory, that's not going to help work out well. And those, right. those conversations aren't helpful. But, you know, Calvin, quite different from Luther temperamentally, but if you throw other figures in there, perhaps is it a Bullinger or others who are more known right. as Irenic, and sometimes the more fiery hardline guys would view him as being kind of soft or a compromiser or, you know, selling the farm, maybe, to use another term.
Right.
I don't view it that way necessarily. So, but we do have to have principles. We do have to always be conformed and reformed by Scripture and never compromise there. But there's something to be said about having a spirit of collegiality, provided that it's always oriented towards arriving at the truth of Scripture.
Yes.
And if people are all on board with that, then we can work there. But if you're isolating yourself, and or if you're spending your days, you know, on social media or on the internet and not interacting with other humans directly, this is a problem and a recipe for disaster.
For sure. Yeah. Well said.
So let's speak about the Meter Center and your involvement. What are we just on the heels of? You just had an event recently.
Right. So the Meter Center is here in Grand Rapids, the H. Henry Meter Center. Mm-hmm. And Henry Meter was a professor of theology at Calvin from 1927 to 1957, so for 30 years. And as it turns out, my paternal grandmother took a class from Henry Meter. She was not a Calvinist at the time, not Reformed. She is more or less now and still alive. And so my grandmother sat in on one of Dr. Meter's classes, and he was apparently a fantastic pedagogue, and wrote an introductory text to Calvinism that was very popular. Mm-hmm. So in 1982, the H. Henry Meter Center for the Study of Calvin was established here, and it's an international center which has an amazing collection of Calviniana, all things related to Calvin, rare books and manuscripts. It has an incredible bibliography. Every year for the last 20 or some years, it has released a comprehensive bibliography in multiple languages of everything written on or about Calvin
wow.
in that current year. So OPC member Paul Fields was the librarian for several decades. It was his responsibility to publish that bibliography. And now there are two other individuals. Dr. Corinne Mogg is the director of the Meter Center, and Sam Ha, I believe, is the archivist. And so scholars come from all over the world to study at the Meter Center. They offer stipends and workshops and internships and these kinds of things. So it's a really nice place to study. It's located on campus here, just a few blocks from where I'm sitting.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And when were you first introduced to it? Did you have experience with it
yes.
before working at Calvin yourself?
Well, as an undergrad, actually, when I was at Calvin from 1991 to 1995 as an undergrad student, I just wandered up to the Meter Center on the fourth floor of the library. And when you pass through the doors, there's a little bell that dings to alert the folks that you're there. And I think that's a safety precaution because they have rare books there, and they don't want an undergrad just wandering off with something. One of the interesting stories about the Meter Center is that a local CRC pastor, this would have been in the late 80s, I believe, was shopping at a thrift store right here in Grand Rapids. And he stumbled across a first edition of Calvin's Institutes that someone had happened to just discard in their giveaway box.
Yikes.
And he had the presence of mind to realize this is extraordinarily valuable. It was valued at 65,000 US or something like that. So then he gave it to the Meter Center, and it's there, and you can see these kinds of books. So it's quite remarkable. So at the time, a man named Richard Gamble, not the Richard Gamble who's the American historian at Hillsdale, but the theologian, I think it might be Richard C. Gamble.
I think they both are, actually.
They have the same middle initial as well?
I might be totally mistaken, but the one that taught at RPTS, I believe, is you're speaking of.
Yeah, that's the one to whom I'm referring. Mm-hmm. He was the director of the Meter Center when I was an undergraduate, and he wore a John Deere hat. And because I was raised on a farm, I felt like we had immediate simpatico. So I went up and talked to him about all things Calvin related. And then as a professor at Calvin, I had some opportunity to interact with the staff there. Now that I'm no longer teaching, they've made me a fellow, which is nice because then I get some library privileges. And so then they asked me this past spring if I would lead one of their summer workshops, which is what I was doing last week.
That's great. Well, tell us about the workshop. What was the subject of it and who was
Right.
participating?
Sure. So Calvin sponsors these, the Meter Center sponsors these summer workshops. In the past, they have been on paleography, how to read Latin texts or French texts. And so these are, made available to any scholar who applies. And so they approached me this past spring and said, would you like to do one of these for the teaching of Latin? And so for the previous 2 summers, this would be 22 and 23, I hosted something like this, not affiliated with any institution, just through my online teaching Latin per diem. And so we called it the Colloquium Aestivum Latinum, the Summer Latin Colloquium. And so this was held at a nearby retreat center. And we invited scholars of any age to come and for 5 days live together, have meals together, fellowship in the evenings together, and then read a wide range of authors spanning pretty much the entire Latin corpus. And so did that in 22 and 23. My wife and my daughter served as the hostesses, making fantastic meals and doing all of this kind of thing. And so we decided to take a break from that specific format. And instead, the Meter Center handled all of those details. And the scholars who came lived on campus in student housing, got their own meals and such. But then we would assemble at Calvin Seminary in a very nice setting to read these Latin authors across the 5 days. So the Meter Center sponsored this, which means that they not only pay for the instruction, but the individuals who are accepted into the program receive a stipend.
Wow.
So each individual received a $500 stipend, which defrays, I think, the majority of the cost of lodging and transportation. So this made it very attractive to students who wanted to improve their Latin. So then with me, they had to take a kind of a competency exam to make sure that we were all at
Yeah.
approximately the same level in terms of
Sure.
ability. And so then we met from Monday through Friday of last week, July 8 through 12, for 5 hours per day, and just read Latin together for that time.
That's tremendous. What, without maybe divulging any
Sure.
personal information of the
Yeah.
participants, but what kinds of activities or walks of life were these people
Yes.
coming from?
Great question. Well, I don't have their permission to use their last names, but I'll
Right.
use their first names because I think pretty much all these first names are so numerous that you couldn't track them down if you wanted. So
Sure.
it was very gratifying that it was an international coterie of students. So there is a man who teaches in the Netherlands, Jan, teaches theology. And so he came over here to participate in this. He's working on Calvin's correspondence. Finished his degree at I can't remember if it's Kampen or Utrecht. And then another fine scholar from your neck of the woods, a friend of mine named Joan, who is an expert in Bonaventure and has an advanced degree in theology from Notre Dame. So Joan is a good friend, and she came to study together. A young man from Texas who teaches at a classical Christian school. Is a fine Latinist, a budding Latinist, and interested in all things classical. A young man from Minnesota, a fellow named Derek, and also a good scholar, very interested in Latin. Let's see, a fellow named David from Maryland, who teaches in a Christian school there, and an excellent Latinist as well. And then we had someone who kind of was a last minute add-on, which I really liked. And this is a Romanian scholar, a man named Emmanuel, who was here for a summer scholar program at the Meter Center, when he found out that we were reading Latin, he said, can I join that, you know, for the first week? Emmanuel's an excellent scholar, interested in Wolfgang Musculus, 16th century reformer. So he participated, actually contributed quite a bit to our time together, and that was excellent.
That's amazing. It must be exciting also to speak with so many different people about their projects. And then I imagine
yes.
in 3 to 5 years, you start to see things coming out, either in print and journals or dissertations, monographs, other
right.
varieties. It's so fun to speak with people as they're working on it. And then after that gets to germinate, cultivate for a while, then start seeing the fruit of their labor.
Absolutely. It's great for me as a student, right? So obviously I was tasked with teaching the class. And, you know, to be frank, Camden, there's plenty of pride and vanity in me. But in the last years, I have tried to present myself as an advanced student, right? So I'm a more experienced student in some areas than others. But I think it's really good to try to see oneself as simply a more experienced student. So one of the things I got to do is, because the sessions contain this Dutch scholar, right, who's a very accomplished scholar in his own right. I mean, I'm ahead of him in Latin, but I'm well behind him in other things, right? It was nice to occasionally give him the floor in terms of, all right, now teach us this perspective. And I even learned a nice Dutch word, which I know very few, but it's the word billig.
Oh.
And billig means something that's trashy or...
Yeah, it's the German word, the comparable German word is cheap.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I was after. And
yeah.
So I said, Jan, teach me this word.
He says, barato in Spanish.
Right. And I said, how's my pronunciation? Right. Because, you know, you can't expect to pronounce anything well without practice, but pronunciation is really just it's an imitative art. You
uh-huh.
know, you hear it
yes.
and you try to form it. So
very musical too. Yeah.
If yeah. You so have people have different mm-hmm. levels of skill with this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so how was it? Right. And he said, I give it like a 65. Oh, come on. I thought it was pretty good. And so as the week went on, either I got better or his grading eased up a little bit.
The curve changed.
You know, yeah, I got some 70s and 80s. And then we had this Romanian scholar as well,
yeah.
Emmanuel. And I didn't really try any Romanian words. But he was very eager to teach about the things that he knows, which are numerous. So...
There's something special about Romania. I've been meeting a whole host of different Reformed Romanian folks through different connections. I was in Budapest earlier this year. I met, I don't know, a dozen people from Romania. Most of them were from Western Romania.
Right.
They were ethnically Hungarian, but I've
okay.
also just spoke. I did an interview with Adonis Vidu, who's Romanian. He teaches in systematics at Gordon Conwell. He's not Hungarian, but he's Romanian. And there's the Lord's used the Romanian people in a variety of ways. It's really unique. We need to get someone on the program to talk about the history of the Reformation in Romania. I'm sure I can.
Well, I can recommend this individual.
Mm.
I think he'd be eager to do it.
Yeah,
and a very interesting person. Excellent English. So.
Well, yes, and they do very as I encapsulate all Romanians into one category, but I mean many of the Romanians I've spoken to
right.
have excellent English, just superb, even those who haven't lived in the States.
Yeah, so this individual Emmanuel is the first Romanian I've ever met, and so I told him, "You're responsible for shaping my entire perception of your whole nation." So.
And
you
no
know,
worries, just understand the whole history of your people is on
right.
your shoulders.
Right.
Tell me about the different authors that you read. It sounds fascinating
yeah.
to come and read for 5 days with all these other scholars, but what were you
right.
what were you introducing them to?
So when I was asked to do this by Corinne Mogg, the director of the center, I said, I'm very eager to do this. I'm gratified, flattered by the invitation. But this is the approach I want to take. What do you think about it? And one of my standard lines when people ask me about reading or translating reformational literature is that I try to tell them, you can't learn Latin properly by going directly to the end point, right? So, in other words, if you want to have the same kind of understanding that Calvin and Beza and Melanchthon, Bucer, etc., if you want to have the understanding that they had, you have to try as much as possible to imitate the education that they had,
Oh,
right?
yes, sure.
Now, that's going to there's going to be obvious limitations to that, but I think if you don't even make an effort, you're in principle doing something incorrect. So someone comes to me and says, "I really want to read Bullinger." I think that's great, and therefore you can't start your study of Latin by reading Bullinger. Because the question, how did Bullinger learn Latin? Bullinger did not learn Latin by reading Bullinger. He didn't learn Latin by reading Luther or even Erasmus. He had to start with those authors who shaped the authors that taught him and the scholars that taught him. So, as much as possible, I know there's lots of limitations, but as much as possible, you want to return to the starting point. Now, when Calvin and these men were mature scholars, obviously they read each other's works, right? Not always really carefully, but they read each other's works. And yet that wasn't the starting point, right? The starting point was Cicero, Sallust, Caesar, Virgil, Ovid. And I have unfortunately met too many budding scholars who want to skip all that and believe you can just jump into Reformation era Latin without a classical background. Now, typically the objection here would be, well, you're telling me to do something that's virtually impossible because Calvin began the study of Latin when he was, 9 or 10. And, I'm a 30-year-old with a family and a pastor and trying to get a PhD. And so what you're telling me is ridiculous. Well, it doesn't have to be exactly like that, right? But my claim is you should make some effort in order to imitate the way that they were educated, if you want to truly understand what they're doing. And I find a lot of support for this from Scott Manich's book, Calvin and the Company of
Oh, it's a
Pastors, right?
tremendous book. Just a
Yes, it
wonderful
is.
book.
And in there, he makes the claim. I don't know the page number or the footnote. I really should have looked that up. But he says every year, Calvin reread the whole of Cicero. Now, I think if I could find the specific piece of correspondence, I think what it would say is that yearly Calvin reread his main philosophical treatises because there were more than 1,000 letters of Cicero that survived, that Petrarch discovered in the 1340s. I don't think Calvin would have had time to reread the entire Ciceronian corpus. But he did reread, I'm sure, the De Officiis, the De Natura Deorum, on ethics. The nature of the gods and the limits of good and evil. I think he probably read those three. And why did he do that? Because he never wanted his Latin skill to gain any mildew or rust. He had to keep it sharp. And part of the reason is nobody would read him if his Latinity were not impressive. So in his letter to Cardinal Sadoleto, which maybe 1540, that's got to be pretty close. I have here the writings of John Calvin, this bibliography by De Greef. So it's there somewhere. But the Latin of that letter against Cardinal Sadoleto, who was trying to draw Geneva back into the Roman fold, the Latin of that letter is superb. It's just gorgeous Latin. And so Calvin had to maintain that level of style in order to have a readership. So, to get back to your question, when I was approached to do this, I said, I'll do it, but I want to spend a couple days trying to expose the students to the sources of Reformation thought before on the fourth and fifth day we get to Reformation thought itself. And they were very, very happy
That's
with
good.
that strategy.
I mean, perhaps to use an analogy, I wonder if you think this holds. But if, and again, it's maybe not so highbrow, but I play guitar,
It's
and
all right.
if you want to, my kids are getting into it, so we've got a little rock band in the basement now. So
Wow, that's
if a kid
great.
wants to, or if, you know, for me, for if somebody wants to play like who knows, let's just say like Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
Well, you don't start by just trying to copy him. Maybe you can try, but it's right. much more appropriate and better to look at the artist's influences and master the catalog of all the steps yes. that built up to what the thing you're trying to imitate or understand actually did. Same as for jazz too. So many of the yeah. masters have learned from people before them, and they learned to copy the solos and all those sorts of things of people, you know, of stepping stones or influential artists before them to comprise their own unique sound. And if you want to replicate right. that sound, you can't really do it effectively without understanding all the parts that combine to create that thing. I would imagine that you can't.
Excellent.
You can understand maybe at a superficial or, you know, surface level what Calvin or others are doing in their Latin or even in the theology. But if you don't go back to the sources that comprise those original sources, then mm-hmm. you're not going to really get to the depths.
That's an excellent analogy. And there was a time when I was, I don't know, 17 or 18. I think I was 18. I wanted to be a drummer, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I went to a friend who was a very accomplished drummer. And I said, I want you to teach me how to hit the snare or whatever it is, the tom, and then throw the stick up and it twirls and I catch it, because I want to be able to do that. I want to be a rock drummer that can do that. He said, okay. So he got me some sticks. He got yeah. me the rubber pad.
Yeah.
Right. And he said, now you're going to do paradiddles.
Exactly.
And all of these, is that the right term?
That's part of it. That's one of the techniques, okay. I believe. Yeah.
And all of these really basic, strike it eight times.
Yeah. They call them rudiments, I yeah. think, in the drum world. Yeah.
It's a Latin world yeah. word, rudimenta. and he said, and eventually I'll teach you how to do that, all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And being 18, I said, yeah, no way.
This is right? a Mr. Miyagi approach.
You right, know, I don't go want to paint do that. The fence. Take me directly to
wax the car.
exactly. So I quit. Right. So I quit. And, thus I don't play the drums at any level, because you just can't, you can't do something really well until you learn to do it poorly.
Yeah.
Right? That's just the,
for what it's worth. I mean, again, I'm not highbrow. We're mixing and match. We're going high, low with the Latin and the classics and then Karate Kid. But,
that's fine.
You got to remember, yep. Most people, probably don't know this, but Pat Morita won the Academy Award for best supporting actor, as far as I understand and remember, for Karate Kid, which is crazy. But there's that special moment. I probably watched it again 6, 7, 8 years ago. But watch that. He goes through that whole, everyone knows that sequence, has ever seen the movie. You know, paint
wax
the fence,
on, wax off.
Paint the fence, sand the floor, wax the car, wax on, right. wax off, all this stuff. And you get it. Like he thinks that he's wasting his time or just using, the boy, Daniel, believes that he's just being used as kind of child labor.
Right.
And he's not actually learning karate. And then he finally confronts Mr. Miyagi and he kind of chews him out. He says, I'm doing all this work for you. You haven't taught me anything. And then he attacks him, you know, and then, you know, he does all the moves and realizes he's been learning all along. I think that moment when right before he attacks him, you see this kind of tear in Mr. Miyagi's eye. I think that's kind of, it's just beautiful, because we don't think yeah. of that as like a really good movie. It's a good movie right. in terms of nostalgia, but just sure. that whole essence there, I think a teacher can watch that portion. And if you understand all of what's going on in the movie at the time, it just really strikes the teacher's heart, because a lot of times what you're asking your students to do, I imagine they don't appreciate or they don't see the value until maybe later. And so it's got to be tough, perhaps, to say you really need to read these things or take 5 years of your life to do these kinds of things if you're going to get right. to where you want to go. And if you don't have that determination, or if a student doesn't have that faith, respect of the teacher, it's just, they're not going to get there. And,
right.
You know,
I would be happy if people would just admit the superiority of what I'm suggesting. If they mm-hmm. can't really follow through on it.
Yeah.
That's a different matter. I sure. don't expect we all have to do things the same way. But if they would just say, yes, I can see what you're saying. I'm going to make an effort. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it goes. I would be very satisfied with that. But I have used that exact sequence when people contact me via email, which happens fairly often, and say, I want to learn Latin, Dr. Noe, how do I do it? The first thing I do is I send them the clip, the YouTube clip of Wax On, Wax Off. And I said, if you'll just follow what I say for a long period of time, mm-hmm. you know, you can do all of this. And oftentimes they kind of flame out. Other times they stick at it. So, but then the question was, what authors did we read? So, we started with Cicero, And we read from his most idiomatic Latin, which are his letters. And I'm going to use the screen share
Oh, here
here
we go. For those
for
watching the
those.
YouTube video or other video, David's sharing the screen. So I'll try to
Yep.
talk us through this, but go ahead, David.
Okay. So this is from a public domain text, the correspondence of Marcus Tullius Cicero by a man named Tyrell. And this was published in 1906. One of the great things about studying these kinds of authors, all the material is absolutely free. And the standards of...
We're living in, it's a crazy world. The riches are extraordinary.
Yes.
If you want
it's
to get
a literary
into
paradise.
Like think of a scholar such as yourself 100 years ago to even
yeah.
imagine what we can do and what we have access to from your house. It would just
Correct.
Be beyond comprehension.
Your phone while you're riding your bike, no matter where you are.
Do you read Latin while you're riding your bike?
Yeah, well, I don't ride a bike. I just do the Latin. And so here is his letter to Atticus.
Yeah.
So this was in 57 BC. I'll read just a touch of Latin. Cicero Atticus Sal. Cicero says, hello. Sal stands for salutem.
Mm.
To his friend Atticus. Cum primum Romam veni fuitque qui recte ad te litteras dardrem niho prius faciendo mihi putavi quam ut tibi absenti de reditu nostro gratulare. As soon as I came to Rome, and there was someone to whom I could give letters intended for you, I decided that the most important thing that I could do was to congratulate you, Atticus, although you were absent, on my return. So this is after Cicero was in exile, and he got brought back to Rome, and he writes this kind of tongue-in-cheek letter saying, Atticus, I'm congratulating you because I'm back.
Right.
And so that's where we started. So why? Because Calvin and company, Ecolampadius, Vermigli Beza, they started by reading Cicero. And they learned it thoroughly because he's a model of good Latinity, obviously.
Mm.
So then from Cicero, we moved on to Seneca. This was all on the first day. And we read from Seneca's De Clementia. So this is his work on mercy or leniency. And for those who are watching the video version, I'll use a screen share again. So, Luci Aenae Senecae ad Nerdronem Caesardrem de Clementia. So, Lucius Aeneas Seneca's work, Mercy de Clementia, to Nero Caesar. Now, the reason I chose this is because in 1532, Calvin published one of his earliest works, which was a commentary on this particular work of Seneca, namely the De Clementia. And Calvin was very hopeful, as your listeners might know, he was very hopeful that this work would put him on the map as a scholar. So he wanted to be the French Erasmus. This was his early ambition. And he didn't have much success. The work was not very popular, but it shaped his thinking in a number of ways. And so when 4 years later, in March of 1536, the first edition of the Institutes was released, it featured a long letter addressed to Francis I. And in that letter, he's basically doing the same thing that Seneca is here doing with respect to Nero. Namely, Calvin is pleading with the king to be lenient and merciful to French Protestants. And so I thought it would be helpful to read a little bit of Seneca's letter to Nero, because it obviously inspired Calvin.
Yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And then the third one, interrupt me at any time, because, you know, when I'm on a favorite subject,
take it away.
Obviously, it's going to be hard to stop.
Run with it.
So the third thing that we looked at, let's see, was from Lactantius. So we moved chronologically. Now, Lactantius was an anti-Nicene church father.
Mm.
And he may have been at the Council of Nicaea in 325. Jerome suggests that he was there. He was the tutor to Constantine's son Crispus. And it was another attempt for a kind of philosopher-king arrangement. So Lactantius was a famous Christian scholar. He wrote the Divine Institutes in seven books. Constantine hired him in order to prepare his son Crispus to inherit the throne. And that turned out very poorly because Constantine eventually had him executed along with Crispus's mother on suspicions of betrayal and plotting. So that didn't work out too well, but Lactantius wrote a number of important works, including this one. So a Liber de Irdra Dei, a book on God's wrath addressed to Donatus. And in this, he takes on the philosophical notion of God not having any actual wrath. And it's not a discussion of impassivity, so far as I can tell. It's more a discussion that God, being a righteous God, does have something akin to the emotion of anger at sin and wickedness. So we didn't go through very much of it. It was just one of the, you know, one of the authors on the first day. But Lactantius has a superbly beautiful style and was much imitated in the Renaissance and was called by the Florentine Platonist Pico della Mirandola, was called the Christian Cicero. And so he was well worth reading.
That's tremendous.
So that's the first day.
Man, that's really amazing. A lot of connection points and interests.
Yes.
The fact checkers have written in, and by that I mean I looked up the internet. But
okay.
Pat Morita was nominated for the Academy Award. I don't want to correct. He did not win it. But in 1984, he was nominated for the Best Supporting Actor. So you don't need to send in your emails and let us know.
But he didn't win. He was just nominated, you're saying.
He was nominated. But still,
okay.
To get nominated, you have to have a good acting performance, you would suspect. Anyway.
But this was after his Happy Days days, right?
Yes. So the 84, Happy Days ended, I guess, the year before in 83. That was, I don't know when the year they jumped the shark, but it was certainly
Arnold's Diner, right? He was Arnold on the, yeah.
So on the first day, you're already dealing with so many of these excellent, authors and working. Do you start branching out into, and eventually arrive at Reformation authors, toward the end of the week?
Yes, we do eventually. Are you getting impatient, Camden?
No, I'm just wondering.
Okay, stick with me. All right. Day two, we started out with Augustine.
Wow.
De Doctrina Christiana, right? Christian doctrine, the four books of Christian doctrine. And this is a text I have read the whole of it in English. I've read large portions in Latin. But this was the first time I taught on it. And one of the things that this is just me, right? Making all allowance for my vanity and pride. But one of the things that I think a teacher needs to do is find things that challenge him or her. If you teach things over and over, there's the real danger of becoming stale, right? So it's easy for me to teach something that I know really well.
Yeah.
But then it's only the students who are challenged. It's not the teacher who's challenged. And one thing that I think students need to see is they need to occasionally see their teacher struggling. Not because he's unprepared, but just because of the difficulty of the task, right? And so I chose this in particular because I had never taught it. And so I wanted a chance to see what I could do with it live, so to speak. And another reason to teach it is because in De Doctrina Christiana, Augustine develops at length the race and signum distinction, right? So there's the content is the race, and then there's the signum, which is the mode of communication. It's the content form distinction, which I understand our friend Cornelius Van Til was not so fond of, right? Mm. Here's where you jump in and correct me, Camden.
Well, the content and the form?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you could take that a couple different ways.
Okay.
But I mean, specifically.
So maybe you don't want to touch that, but I thought that he was very emphatic that form and content are relatively indistinguishable.
Well, I would have to understand that. Well, certainly I could see that in one respect, but in another, depending if someone's coming from a different angle, like someone might argue, for example, that Van Til is an idealist because he used idealist terms and those sorts of things. And there, I would see that absolutely not. I would argue very strongly against that idea that he was one of the sharpest and firmest critics of idealism. So I guess I'd have to know more about what we're
well,
speaking
we
about
that
specifically.
Aside,
but certainly in other regards, he would certainly look at like regarding Thomas Aquinas and whatnot, and try to understand more specifically the system of thought that's going into any particular doctrine. So there's an aspect there too where Van Til's not wanting to atomize everything, but look at somebody's theology and someone's apologetic as a whole, as a connected whole, and try to understand how all the parts correspond there. So there's a bunch, perhaps, different angles to get at the question.
Well, I didn't mean to open up a Vermium Ampulla, right? A bottle of worms. So, but it's in De Doctrina Christiana that Augustine deals with the res signum distinction, right? The content and then the marker that communicates the content. Mm. And of course, the reformers mined this endlessly in their discussion of the Eucharist, right? The sign and the signifier, yes. Right? There's the thing, right? The bread, the water, the wine, and the sacraments. And then what does it signify, right? And this is where the dispute went. So after dealing with Augustine, we skipped way ahead to the 12th century to Bernard of Clairvaux and read a little bit of his first sermon on the Song of Songs, the Cantica Canticorum, and did that because, of course, after Augustine, Bernard is the single greatest influence on Calvin among the fathers, which is surprising because he's also known for his strong Marian devotion, right? If you want to get a very strong dose of devotion to Christ's mother in a way that I think Protestants rightly believe is excessive, you'll find it in Bernard de Clairvaux. Calvin didn't borrow those things from Bernard, but his discussion of the human will and of the process of salvation is very significant in the Institutes and quoted more than any other father except Augustine. And third, we looked on the second day at Aquinas' Against the Gentiles, Contra Gentiles, just a little bit of that.
Yeah, another very important work.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. Yeah, so many people have probably read various Reformed works, the Institutes and other titles, and seen so many of these classic authors mentioned, but just have never read any of them or even understand the significance of them. But these are so many standard texts that just anyone who was educated at the time would have been well familiar with these things and would certainly have understood the context. And if we're shortchanging ourselves by not understanding those contexts, then we're missing an enormous portion of the background of whatever work we're reading.
Right. And so part of my goal and one of the reasons I'm so grateful that you've given me this time to talk to your listeners is simply to inspire people to aspire to these things, right? So I don't think it's reasonable to believe that you or I, or maybe anybody, can reach the level of learning that these men in the 16th century possessed in these areas, right? Because many of them were, you know, just geniuses and they had such fantastic teachers from an early age. But even if we can't do that, we shouldn't give up the goal altogether of learning something about Bernard of Clairvaux and something about Aquinas and company, and really, you know, devoting ourselves to as much as possible, I would suggest.
How does this look for somebody? We're speaking more, maybe more emphasizing accessing this, this information, or even maybe achieving some level of mastery or deeper understanding. What does this look like for you, for example? Now, you mentioned that you're a perpetual student. We all are. But once you've achieved a certain awareness or knowledge, what does this look like in terms of maintaining and I don't know, retaining a familiarity with these? Do you have any suggestions or any personal practices that you engage in that people might be interested to hear?
Yes, I have a number of boring things to say. But you want to do that before we go to day three?
Let's go to day three. Let's finish the days, and then we'll
then we can talk about.
Yeah, that's a good.
I'll try to be more brief. Day three, in chronological order, was Lorenzo Valla.
This is not a framework approach to your
Anytime I can bring Klein in, I'm happy to do so. And yeah, Klein was a good Latinist. I was listening to his lectures on Kingdom Prologue, and he quotes some Latin here and there during that. And I can just tell by the way that he quotes the Latin, that
Really?
he understands it. Yep.
Wow.
I can tell by the way he quotes it that the emphases are in the right place and so forth. Someone taught him well. I'm sure of that. So day three is Lorenzo Valla on the freedom of the will, De Libertate Arbitrii. And I'm convinced, relying on the work of Renaissance scholar Charles Trinkaus, that Valla really understood an Augustinian conception of the will and contributed a great deal to the understanding of the reformers in the 16th century. So Valla was 15th century. After that, we read Guillaume Boudet, who was a friend and acquaintance of Calvin and a brilliant Hellenist. He was much older than Calvin. He had strong Lutheran sympathies, but kept them secret for the majority of his life, and so escaped a scrutiny and
It's a
persecution.
crypto-Lutheran, an actual crypto-Lutheran.
I think so. Yep.
Usually that's just
Others,
something, a name people call each other.
right? Yeah. Two kingdom folks are crypto Lutherans, right? But everyone in that supposedly in that generation who was not in fellowship with Rome was called Lutherani, right? So Calvin was called a Lutheran and Zwingli was called a Lutheran
Yeah, they didn't have any other categories for them, right?
until much later. And Erasmus, in fact, famously said about the Anabaptists that they were Lutherani or Zwinglio, more Lutheran than Zwingli, was his cut at the Anabaptists. So we read his transition from Hellenism to Christianity, just a few pages. And then third, we read Erasmus's work on writing letters. And Erasmus, whom I'm not really fond of, but I just stand in awe of his brilliance. He's just a fantastic mind. And so, Calvin, Beza, all these men were reading Erasmus, lots of Erasmus, and mostly disagreeing with him, because he never embraced Lutheran principles publicly. So that's day three. Day
Goodness.
four, now we're actually on reformers. So we read two things. We read first John Ecolampadius, his letter to some brothers who were preaching the gospel in the vicinity of Basel. And so I'm going to put this on screen because I think it looks really interesting. Those who are watching the video, they'll maybe like this. If I can get this loaded here.
Here it comes.
All right, so
Oh,
here we go.
interesting.
So here's the title page. Ioannes Ecolampadii ad fratres qui Evangelium Christi in Agro Basiliensi annuntiat epistula Padrinetica ut vitae doctrinae quae ac ceremoniarum puritatem in omnibus sectentur. So the guy's name is first John Ecolampadius. This is an epistula Padrinetica, which means a hortatory letter or a letter of encouragement to the brothers who are proclaiming the gospel of Christ in the region around Basel. And it's a letter urging them, ut sectentur, that they should pursue a purity of life, of doctrine, and of religious practice in all things. So this was written at Basel by Valentin Curio. He was the publisher. And this was written in 1528.
It's amazing. You could
And
just access that right with a computer. That's amazing.
and Ecolampadius, a fantastic Latinist also, a personal friend of Erasmus, longtime resident of Basel, and Amy Nelson Burnett, a scholar at the University of Nebraska, who has written on Ecolampadius extensively. It's her claim, and I think she's right, that Ecolampadius was the first individual in this generation to grasp fully the concept of the spiritual presence of Christ in the supper, and that every development of Calvin, of Vermigli, Beza thereafter, was a development from Ecolampadius's original insight. And I think that he got this because Ecolampadius was the best patrologist, a student of the Church Fathers, the best patrologist of his generation, outstripping even Erasmus in that. In that category. So knew the church fathers better than anybody else. And from this drew his idea, specifically Augustine and Cyril, of the spiritual presence of the Lord in the supper.
Wow. What did you move to on day five? If you're already reading Reformers on day four, do you just go later into the tradition, or do you branch
out? We have one other reformer on day four, and that is, you know, since this was sponsored by Calvin University's H. Henry Meter Center, and that is we read Calvin himself. So I want to open this and very briefly show the viewers here. If I can get this open.
Were people surprised when they finally got to reading? I mean, did the previous readings change people's perception of this particular work?
That's an excellent question. I think so. Yeah. I don't know how profoundly or to what extent. Mm-hmm. Many of the individuals, you know, there were six total plus me as instructor. Mm-hmm. Most of these folks had some sense already of the argument that, you know, I laid out a while ago, which mm-hmm. is you can't just approach the reformers without any context. They, you know, they were already very sympathetic to that idea.
Yeah.
But here is Calvin's Defensio Orthodoxae Fidei de Sacra Trinitate contram prodigiosos errores Michaela Cerveti Hispani. So this is Calvin's defense of the Orthodox faith of the Sacred Trinity against the monstrous errors of Michael Servetus, the Spaniard. And this has never been put into English. This was published by Robert Etienne in 1554. So it was after Servetus's trial and execution. And in this work, it says 12 pages up here, but I've just excerpted it. It's about 280 pages. Calvin defends himself and his doctrine in terms of what happened. And Calvin's Latin is also superb. It's as good as anybody's and better than most in this generation. So we just looked at a little bit of it. He also defends here. He says, "Hierreticos iure gladii coercendos esse." That heretics should be punished, or rightly punished, with the sword. So that's a very unmodern conclusion, you know, to draw. But that's a part of this treatise also. And so that's what we were looking at.
Goodness.
So that's day four. Day and four. Finally, day five, we dealt with two works, excerpts from 1 Peter Martyr Vermigli, a really fascinating work. His Dialogus de Utraque in Christo Natura, which is his dialogue on the two natures in Christ. So we looked at this first from Vermigli. It's like a Platonic dialogue in which two characters, Pantakos, it's got a Greekish name, meaning Mr. Everywhere, and Orothetes, Mr. Limitation, right? So Mr. Everywhere is the Lutheran position.
Yeah.
The body of Christ is ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous.
And Orothetes, Mr. Limitation, is the person through whom Vermigli speaks, right? It's his spokesman. And they have a long argument in very sophisticated and witty terms about who is right on the nature of the supper. And so we read three or four pages of that. And, you know, Vermigli, the men of the 16th century whose Latin I enjoy the most are probably in this order: Beza, Calvin, Vermigli, because they're just superbly witty in their style. It's really fun to read.
When you say they're witty, is it the humor? Is it the turn of a phrase? Is it
all of that?
All of it together. Wow.
Just in the you know, the titles of his characters, right? Yeah. Pantakos and Orothetes. And the way that he's imitating the Platonic dialogue in setting out, you know, where are you coming from, Orothetes, that you show up here on my doorstep? And then the other guy says, I just came from the bookseller and I was looking over some brand new books. And there was one that really got under my skin because it was talking about Christ's ubiquity. And then they launch into a discussion. And finally, we read a little bit of one of Beza's theological letters. These were published in 1573. Beza is a superb logician and a superb stylist. So those are the 5 days. And what was your next question?
That's amazing. And it makes me want to dive in and study these sorts of things. But I was asking, so that's the introduction. That's a wonderful introduction. I was curious to know also, you know, what's this look like in the future, and what are some things that you do perhaps to stay sharp, not just to acquire the skills or knowledge of the context, but to review, to maintain. What are some personal disciplines or habits that you've incorporated into your daily life?
Yes, great question. So seeking to be an advanced student, right?
Mm-hmm.
First, you never stop learning, and you have to have really clear, one has to have really clear goals and a very long time horizon, right? And the long time horizon is to ask oneself, not what do I want to know tomorrow or in a week, but what do I want to know in 3 years, or what do I want to know in 10 years is even better.
Wow.
And a way to not lose hope in, you know, in the face of the massive amount of knowledge there is to try to acquire, and the, you know, the persistent ignorance, is to take a kind of measure of one's knowledge at certain points, right? So this is the advice I give to Latin students, and which I try to apply to myself. Take 30 minutes, get, you know, 30 pieces of blank paper and a pencil, remove all distractions. So no watching Karate Kid during this time.
Exactly.
and try to write down everything that you know about Latin in that 30 minutes. And if you can only fill one page, well, that might be a little bit discouraging, but it's also an excellent measure of your current status.
Yeah.
And then set it aside and don't look at it, and develop good study habits for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then repeat the same exercise and then compare, right? Because then you will notice inevitably a tremendous amount of progress.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to think, you know, I want to master Latin in a year, it's just not going to happen. It's virtually impossible. You really have to have a long time horizon. So some of the things that I do is I try to memorize Psalms in Latin. I try to memorize prayers in Latin, Protestant ones, of course. I try to memorize little snippets from the classical authors. And a lot of this stuff I share freely through the, you know, the various online teaching that
yes,
I do.
We'll link to those. Sure.
And also just copying out Latin things that are interesting, keeping a notebook, reviewing the notebook. The other thing as a teacher is, I've already sort of mentioned it, whenever someone is interested in learning something from me, I try to introduce some variation for my own sake in the approach that I take. Don't always use the same textbook. Don't always give the same thing to memorize. Challenge yourself, right, in terms of acquiring new knowledge. I could give you more specific details if the format allowed, but there are handbooks of Latin synonyms. There are Latin dictionaries which define Latin words with Latin words, right? And I just sit down with a pencil and paper and I just copy these out, right? And it's slow and tedious. It's what the papal Latinist, the late Reginald Foster, Milwaukee native, called bun work, right? There's no substitute for bun work. You have to sit your behind down and just do the work,
right?
You don't have to do only that all the time, but you're not going to learn anything.
Right.
Yeah, you just have to wax on, wax off, right? And so it's a lot of that. And it's tedious and dull and unglamorous, but over the long haul, it pays off tremendously, right?
You've mentioned, you know, there are ways to gauge your progress by doing those little self-exams and keeping that stuff on record, which I really like. You know, there's this CEFR, the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages, when we're speaking about learning living languages. It's very common when you're learning, you know, modern languages that are being spoken today. So they have different levels that go from A1 to C2 that are very specific diagnostic evaluations that determine what level you're at. And sometimes those might be used in job hiring or whether you can be admitted to a university. You have to test at a certain level, or if you're going to be a translator, whatnot. There's all sorts of uses for that. I have no clue if there's ever such a thing for an ancient language, or if
I don't think there's anything that is
something that I formal could, maybe, but
yes, I could well be wrong, but I have developed a number of things similar to that, primarily for Latin, a little bit for Greek, in which you can test yourself, not with such a specific diagnostic.
Got it.
But if there's someone to help you interpret the results,
you know where you're
right,
at,
then you could get it. So I'm not going to do this to you right now, Camden, but I know you've studied some Latin. If we had 15 minutes, you know, I could give you a diagnostic and, you know, give you a pretty good sense of here's where your knowledge is excellent and strong.
Yeah.
Here are some
not much
areas of growth. And over here are the things that we probably better not talk about, you know, in polite company.
Yeah, so. I got it. Yeah. My Latin is extremely minimal and DIY.
That's okay.
But, yeah, I did not pass. I did not attempt to study Latin for my PhD, although I should have. But I did my French and German. Even though I studied a Catholic, a lot of his influences were mostly in German. And he wrote in German, but then French,
right,
too.
That's great.
But, yes, it's still something that any theologian ought to be interested in learning some Latin. And
I would agree with that, yeah.
It's just an enormous influence.
When Peter Martyr Vermigli left Rome in 1548 and left Lucca, Italy, went over the Alps and showed up in Strasbourg, basically on Martin Bucer's doorstep. Bucer wrote a letter to Calvin and he said, "Vir quidam ab Italia venit, ad modum doctus tribus linguis." This guy just showed up from Italy and he is amazingly learning ad modum doctus in the three languages. Now, the three languages were not Italian, French, and German. They were Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. And so that made Vermigli so useful to the church. It allowed him to teach in Zurich for a long time, to teach at Oxford for a long time. So, yeah, I really just want to encourage men and women who are listening to pursue these things, and also, you know, give them the promise that I'll help them. If they want to contact me, I'll teach them how to wax on and wax off.
Oh, that's the way to do it. Tell us about Latin Per Diem and perhaps some of your other online ventures, because people might want to take the step.
Sure. So this website, latinperdiem.com, is where I offer my free Latin instruction. So it's a YouTube channel. And there are, I think right now, 2,083 free Latin and Greek instructional videos. So it's not comprehensive, but the vast majority of authors that someone could think of, I have done something from them. So there is Bucer, there's Calvin, there's Vermigli, there's Ecolampadius. So all of the persons I listed here, plus a lot more. And I think this is really a useful way to sample the broad scope of the Latin language. But I've also developed these Google quizzes, right?
Oh,
so
nice.
When you are asking about a diagnostic,
yes,
I have more than 400 of these that are available for free. I do sell some of them through Patreon, but more than 400 that are free. And the idea is you watch the 4-minute video, then you immediately take this quiz in Google Forms.
Yes.
And you get immediate feedback. It will tell you, you know, you scored 10 out of 12, or you got 4 out of 8, and then it'll show you your mistakes. And my friend Joan, whom I mentioned before, is writing some of these now, and they're superb. Not just, you know, grammar and logic, but some history mingled in there. And again, it's the kind of do a little bit each day, right? Like your guitar playing.
Oh, yes.
Don't say, you know, next year I'll be Clapton, but I'm going to practice for 20 minutes per day, right? That's a huge accomplishment. That kind of discipline and routine long-term bears tremendous fruit. So that's latinperdiem.com. Also have a Greek program that I use to teach Greek mossmethod.com. And then a little podcast. And I was so glad that last time I was on here, Camden, some people came and listened to our podcast because you had promoted me. I was so grateful for that.
Well, I'm glad people are finding worthwhile and good resources. So we love to tell people about them because people can benefit. Yeah. And we'll put links to all of these things in the episode description and continue to discuss them further. This is excellent. Are there any other matters, at least regarding the Meter Center or other activities that people might want to check out or add to their calendar in the near or not too distant future?
Yes. Well, I just want to express first my gratitude to the Meter Center and to its director, Dr. Corinne Mogg and Sam Ha, and invite your listeners to go to the page and check out the things that they offer. I don't know of any specific programs upcoming. And I think one of the things that they like to do in terms of these summer workshops is they like to, you know, quite understandably, vary the scholars who are presenting. So I don't think that necessarily I would be doing this next year, probably some other topic, some other scholar. But I'll be teaching some Latin next summer somewhere. So if people are interested, you know, even if they said, I know zero Latin, but I would like to participate in something like this. If you began today or tomorrow, in a year's time, if you're disciplined, you might almost be ready to participate.
Wow.
And if not in a year's time, in 2 years or 3 years, right? This compounding of knowledge and experience is really the key to, I would say, gaining competence.
Yeah, that's tremendous. We really appreciate it. How are things going at church? Any mention if people are traveling through the GR where they might want to come by Reformation and maybe have
thanks,
a sausage?
Yeah. God is very gracious, and the congregation, we have slow incremental growth, for which we're thankful. I'm talking about numerical growth.
Yes.
As for the spiritual growth, we're just trusting that to the Lord and seeing what will happen. It's so gratifying to pastor a congregation of godly and loving people. You know, I'm a total novice at being a pastor. I was a scholar for a long time. I've been a pastor only a couple years. But I'm thankful for the ruling elders, for the all the members, the deacons.
Amen.
And preaching through Isaiah now. So up to chapter 41 this coming Lord's Day. So there's the possibility, at least, that we might finish the book. It's the longest in other than the Psalms in terms of the number of chapters.
Yeah.
And then preaching on the Gospel of Matthew in the evening. And,
oh, that's great.
I'm learning so much. I hope the congregation is as well.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Well, I'm glad to hear that. We'll certainly keep you in prayer, and we'll put links
Thank
to
you.
All the various outlets and churches and institutions in the episode description for people to follow up. But this has been a tremendous pleasure, David. We hope to have you back soon. We're also working on another conversation on another translation project and John Arrowsmith's work,
right.
Some of his work on spiritual disciplines and holy war. So
yes.
Really, really excited about that. So we hope to feature that in coming weeks. So keep your eyes open for the podcast feed for that as well. But David, thanks for joining me and speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Camden. Take care.
We'll have everything available, as I mentioned, online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information also not only about this program, but our other programs and events and other publications and activities. I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.